Good evening. My name is Simone Olalgatur, and I'm the current director of Yungurindi First Nations Centre for Higher Education and Research at Flinders University, and I'm your MC for tonight. I welcome you all to the 2012 sixth annual oration in honour of Dr. Lodger O'Donoghue, held as one of the key events in Reconciliation Week. I would formally like to acknowledge distinguished guests here tonight, His Excellency Rear Admiral Kevin Skares, Governor of South Australia, and Mrs. Liz Skares, Auntie and Dr. Lodger O'Donoghue, Miss Frances Bedford, Member of Florey representing the Premier, the Honourable Stephen Wade, representing the Leader of the Opposition, Miss Isabel Redmond, MP, Mrs. Bronwyn Daunt, daughter of Don Dunstan, and Mr. Rodney Daunt, Professor James McCaw and Mrs. Lindsay McCaw, the Honourable Justice Robin Layton QC, and Professor Peter Buckskin, co-chair of Reconciliation South Australia, Professor Gary Davis, representing Flinders University Vice-Chancellor, Professor Michael Barber. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to acknowledge and ask Uncle Lewis, Dr. Lewis O'Brien, Garnet Elder, to welcome us here tonight. Uncle Lewis.
Marawijunga, Garnamiyan and Iwangani, Mani Nabudni Gani Adana, Nibirko, Mankalankala, Tandanya, Mianaku. Nature Yunganalia, Nature Yakanandalia, Padne Adlu Wadu. On behalf of the Kaurna people, I welcome you all to Kaurna country, and I do this ambassador of the Adelaide Plains people. My brothers, my sisters, let's walk together in harmony. Natalia.
Thank you, Uncle Lewis, for welcoming us to Kaurna country tonight. I would now like to welcome Professor James McCaw, Vice-Chancellor of the University of Adelaide, to introduce to you our orator for tonight, the Honourable Michael Kirby. In welcoming Professor McCaw, I note that this will be one of his final appearances as the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Adelaide, having announced that he will retire from the position at the end of this month. The Don Dunstan Foundation particularly wishes to acknowledge Professor McCaw's excellent leadership of the University of Adelaide over the last 10 years and the very appropriate Australian honour he was awarded late last year. The Foundation trustees are enormously appreciative of his commitment to the Foundation and his continuing generous support for its works. Professor McCaw's contribution will be missed. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor McCaw.
Thank you very much, Simone, for your very generous words. His Excellency Rear Admiral Kevin Skares and Mrs. Liz Skares, Dr. Luicia O'Donoghue, Ms. Frances Bedford, Mr. Stephen Wade, the Honourable Lina Arnold, who is the Chair of the Don Dunstan Foundation, Mrs. Bronwyn Daunt, Mr. Rodney Daunt, the Honourable Robin Layton, and Professor Peter Buckskin, co-chairs of Reconciliation LA, SA, Mr. Bill Cossey, other distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it's wonderful to welcome you all here this evening, and I would like to first acknowledge the Kaurna people, the original custodians of the Adelaide Plains, and the land on which the University of Adelaide's campuses, here at North Terrace, at Waite, at Theberton, and at Roseworthy, are built. And a special thank you to Uncle Lewis O'Brien for your Kaurna welcome. It's always wonderful to have you along on our campus, and you take a tremendous amount of time to join us and to ensure that we conduct our business in an appropriate manner. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here tonight and to welcome you all to the University of Adelaide for this annual Reconciliation Week event, the Luicia O'Donoghue Oration. The University of Adelaide is firmly committed to reconciliation and the principles of social justice. We're working hard to turn this commitment into real and sustainable outcomes in higher education participation for Aboriginal people and for their communities. We're also keen to raise awareness in the wider community of the issues surrounding reconciliation and the continuing injustices and inequity that remain for Aboriginal people. That's why we are proud to support the Don Dunstan Foundation in its pursuit of a greater understanding of social justice issues and desire to influence change towards a fair, just, and inclusive society. We're very pleased to be able to host this event held in honor of Dr. Luicha O'Donoghue. She has spent her life helping to improve the lives of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, and she's a key figure in the nation's attempts to reconcile black and white. Indeed, Black and White Together was the title of her original speech at the inaugural Luicha O'Donoghue Oration in 2007. Since then, the Don Dunstan Foundation has brought to us a series of distinguished speakers for the annual oration. And tonight, I'd like to warmly welcome another eminent Australian to the University of Adelaide's campus. The Honourable Michael Kirby has an outstanding record as a jurist and a human rights advocate. When he retired from the High Court of Australia in 2009, he was Australia's longest-serving judge. His distinguished career included serving on the Australian Conciliation and Arbitration Commission, the Australian Law Reform Commission, the Federal Court of Australia, the New South Wales Court of Appeal, and the Court of Appeal of the Solomon Islands. He was acting Chief Justice of Australia twice. He has also served on many national and international bodies and human rights organizations. Although retired from the judiciary, he continues as honorary visiting professor at 12 universities and participates regularly in many local and international conferences and meetings. In 2010, Michael Kirby became the first Australian to be awarded the prestigious Gruber Justice Prize for his championing of victims of injustice and discrimination, and for his role in the development of international human rights law. We've been honored to have Michael Kirby here at the University of Adelaide on several occasions when he has generously given up his time to present public lectures, and on one occasion, the law school's James Crawford Lecture. He's renowned for his forward thinking, for his erudite views, and for the compassionate contribution he has made, both in law and in human rights. I'm sure he's got much to contribute to the understanding of issues around social justice for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, and we're privileged to have him with us here tonight. I would ask you please to join with me in welcoming Michael Kirby.
Look up, my people. The dawn is breaking. The world is waking to a new bright day where none defame us, no force detain us, nor colour shame us, nor sneer dismay. The words of Kath Walker, Oojuru of the Noonuckle, to start this encounter this evening. Your Excellency the Governor, the beloved Luicha O'Donoghue, other distinguished citizens, it's a wonderful thing to be in this magnificent hall on this special evening. And I too acknowledge the Kaurna people, and I regret the wrongs that were done in the law and are still done in the law to the Indigenous people of our country. We must right those wrongs. I also acknowledge the wonderful contribution of Don Dunstan to our nation. And I'm very glad that Bronwyn Don't is here tonight, his daughter, to hear me say how grateful I am to him that it was Don Dunstan who introduced the first law to remove the wrongs to another group of Australians, the sexual minorities, who are still wronged. We will see this week a continuation of the work that Don Dunstan began, but we won't see it completed. I feel the pain of the Aboriginal people because I too have been discriminated against. And we must right the wrongs to the Aboriginal people and to the gay people and to every other group in our community, women, Asian Australians, people of colour, anyone who suffers discrimination and inequality in the law must have a remedy, and things must be changed, and things will be changed, thanks to leadership of people like Loitsha O'Donoghue and Don Dunstan. We need champions and we need heroes, and my talk tonight is about champions and heroes. Mid-2012 is a time for serious reflection about the Indigenous people. The country has before it a report of a panel on the desirability of a change to the Australian Constitution so as to express provisions relating to Aboriginal Australians and to insert a preamble acknowledging their special place in our nation. But in the current fragile political circumstances, would any referendum fail and thereby add discouragement to the hopes of Indigenous advancement? Hope and fear of failure are the twin companions on this journey. Looking backward, it's now 45 years since, on the 27th of May 1967, a referendum was held adopting amendments to the Constitution to remove provisions that discriminated against Aboriginals. The referendum was carried by an affirmative vote of the Australian electors, and optimistically, Australians hoped that the goodwill signalled by such a positive vote was a sign that a page had been turned forever in the history of our country. Since the referendum, with the resulting amendments to the Constitution, there have been enactments and decisions of great importance for the journey that we recognise we had to take. The National Apology in the Federal Parliament in 2008 by Prime Minister Rudd was an important high point, rich in symbolism and in grace. So have been the amendments to the state constitutions acknowledging the First People, although generally these have been premised on an express requirement that the amendment did not give rise to any justiciable rights, when even John Batman gave out a few beads. Some of the court decisions since 1967 have not in their result proved favourable to the interests of Aboriginals, and of these I'd mention most particularly Cartignieri against the Commonwealth, the Hindmarsh Bridge case, Yorta Yorta against Victoria, the proof of continuity of native title case, and Wirragil against the Commonwealth, the Northern Territory intervention case. All were decisions of the High Court of Australia. The first, over the Hindmarsh Bridge, rejected Justice Lionel Murphy's historical view that the amendments to the Constitution in 67, empowering the Federal Parliament to make laws with respect to the people of any race for whom it is deemed necessary to make special laws, was not to be read in for whom as confined to the benefit of for the benefit of whom such laws were deemed to be necessary. Only Justice Mary Gaudron and I were attracted to that interpretation. In Yorta Yorta, in joint reasons, Justice Gaudron and I dissented, as Chief Justice Black had done in the Federal Court, in relation to the way in which Aboriginals claiming native title rights had to prove continuity of interest in the maintenance of their traditional customs over the land. And in Wirrigal, over my sole dissent, the High Court of Australia upheld the constitutional validity of the federal legislation authorising what has become known as the Northern Territory Intervention. This imposes special restrictions and controls on Aboriginals in that territory, reminiscent of the special protections of the 19th century colonial patriarchy. By the time that case was decided in 2009, Justice Gaudron had concluded her service on the High Court, as indeed I was immediately after myself to do. Wirrigal was the last decision made in the last hours of my time on the High Court of Australia. But despite these decisions, and doubtless many others, three judgments of the High Court since the referendum have generally been hailed in Aboriginal and other circles as advancing the legal and economic interests of Australia's Indigenous peoples. These were, first, Kuata against Bjelke-Petersen, which upheld the challenge to the actions of the then Queensland government inconsistent with the Racial Discrimination Act of the Commonwealth. Secondly, Mabo against Queensland, which upheld the existence of native title as a legal possibility in the Australian system of land law. And thirdly, Wik Peoples against Queensland, which endorsed the compatibility of native title as upheld in Mabo and given effect in federal legislation, alongside pastoral leases over vast areas of the Australian continent. The Kuata decision was delivered on the 11th of May, 1982, so it's exactly 30 years ago this month. The Mabo decision was delivered on the 3rd of June, 1992, 20 years ago next Sunday. The Mabo decision is much better known than either Kuata or Wik. On the 7th of May, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation broadcast a special edition of Four Corners dedicated to reflections on Mabo. Several university conferences on the Mabo decision have also been convened. But without the earlier decision of the High Court in Kuata, it's doubtful that the Mabo decision, and particularly the Wik decision, would have had any impact whatsoever. If in Kuata, the Racial Discrimination Act of the Commonwealth had been held invalid as lacking a constitutional validity, the protection of federal law against the threatened bucket loads of extinguishment of native title would have been missing. The general principle of Mabo and the specific extension of it in Wik to pastoral leases would probably have been rendered nugatory, and quickly. State and territory laws and state executive action would immediately have swept the dreams of native title into the dustcan of lost hopes. At this time of anniversary, we should therefore remember Eddie Koiki Mabo and his struggles through the courts of Australia. However, we should also remember the earlier struggles of John Kuata to uphold the validity of the Racial Discrimination Act and to use that act to strike down as invalid the inconsistent move of the government of Queensland Premier Johannes Bjelke-Petersen to frustrate John Kuata's search for legal rights in his traditional lands, rights potentially of great cultural importance to the spirit of the Winchi Anam people from whom Eddie Mabo and John Kuata sprang, but also rights potentially important to the economic and social survival of their communities in an often hostile environment in contemporary Australia. The people behind these great test cases that came to the highest courts in the land are rarely, if ever, known to the judges or indeed to the general community. When they have died, respect must be paid to the sensibilities of religious customs and to the inhibitions that exist in some Aboriginal circles upon reproducing their photographs and images. And I mean no disrespect to these traditions by their display of their images tonight. In the case of Eddie Koiki Mabo, he is such an important figure in the history of Australia that it's inevitable that books, film documentaries, and even feature films will portray him and his family. For us, his fellow citizens, to look on his real or simulated features. As is well known, although Eddie Mabo lived to see the first decision of the High Court in his long saga of litigation, he died just a few months before the announcement of the second decision that will forever carry his name into the history books of this country. We listen to the Eddie Mabo story and that of his people. We stare at his image and at the actors who attempt to reproduce his determination, his strength, his resilience. Although justice in his case came after his death, he had already won a number of moral victories against discrimination on the grounds of his race. And the same is true of John Koata. There's much less public knowledge of this early hero in the struggle of Australia's Indigenous people to establish legal entitlements over their traditional lands. However, Marcia Langton has begun the process of correcting this gap in our knowledge. She has explained the derivation of his name and the links that his name gives to the leech and the dingo, symbols that John Koata affirmed. John Koata wanted to secure action on the part of the Aboriginal Land Fund Commission. It had been established under federal law, enacted with bipartisan support during the Whitlam government. John Koata wanted the commission to acquire a pastoral lease in northern Queensland on the Archer River in the Wick country. Neither John Koata nor his community had the wherewithal to acquire the holding, but the Aboriginal Land Fund Commission had been established for precisely this purpose. He and other members of that clan requested the Commission to acquire the lease so as to enable the land to be used by and for the members of the clan for their traditional purposes and for their immediate contemporary livelihood. The Commission immediately acceded to this request and it set about allocating the funds to permit the request to be fulfilled. The Aboriginal Land Fund Commission was comprised of resolute members, five in number. Under the Act, three were to be of Aboriginal descent and two were not. But there were no recorded disagreements within the Commission about affording the funds to pay the necessary money to fulfil John Koata's dream. An excellent and detailed examination by Associate Professor Alexander Riley of the University of Adelaide Law School has explained the struggle that then unfolded between the Commission and officials of the Government of Queensland led by Premier Bjelke Petersen. This is a story of bricks and mortar necessary for the advancement of the dignity and economic and legal entitlements of the Indigenous people of Australia. Under the Land Act 1962 of Queensland, any sale or transfer of a pastoral lease was subject to a veto by the Minister for Lands of the state. The solicitors for the Commission secured the approval to the transfer of the then lessees, and they then sought the permission of the Minister for the transfer. In June 1976, the government officials of Queensland indicated that the Minister had rejected the transfer, and his reasons were quite blunt. Quote, "The question of the proposed acquisition of Archer River Pastoral Holdings comes within the ambit of the declared government policy expressed in Cabinet decisions of September 1972, which stated, the Queensland Government does not view favourably proposals to acquire large areas of additional freehold or leasehold land
for development by Aborigines or Aboriginal groups in isolation." End quote. Because this stated policy had been affirmed and reaffirmed by the Queensland Cabinet, John Kawata concluded that he and his group were being denied their entitlements by reason of their Aboriginal race. Guided by excellent lawyers, led by the late Ron Caston QC of the Melbourne Bar, who was later also to act for Eddie Mabo, John Kawata decided to initiate proceedings in the High Court of Australia invoking the Racial Discrimination Act. This enactment made any discriminatory act based on racial grounds illegal by federal law. John Kawata's action immediately provoked the state of Queensland, for its part, to challenge the validity of the Racial Discrimination Act. That challenge, in turn, led Mr. Kawata to argue that the Act was valid as a special law based on the race's power, as it had been amended in the 1967 referendum. But he also based his argument on the external affairs power of the Australian Constitution, because the Racial Discrimination Act gave effect to an international convention against racial discrimination. A majority of the High Court, Chief Justice Gibbs with Justices Stephen, Aitken and Wilson, rejected John Kawata's reliance on the race's power. But another majority, Justices Stephen, Mason, Murphy and Brennan, upheld the validity of the Racial Discrimination Act based on the external affairs power, and they did so for reasons that they severally expressed. The narrowest expression was that of Justice Stephen, who had switched from a majority against the race's power to a majority for the external affairs power. His view of the external affairs power included reference to the public engagement of the national government of our country with other nations, things or circumstances beyond Australia. He recognised the growing significance in international law of the global prohibition against racial discrimination that followed the knowledge of the Holocaust and other genocides in and after the Second World War. Such prohibition had become a central purpose of international law, and as he put it in his reasons, it is a purpose which more than any other dominates the thoughts and actions of the post-World War II world. And a similar point was later to be made by Justice Brennan in the Mabo decision. Normally, other judges, lawyers, and the public generally are afforded very few insights into the modes of thinking of decision makers in courts such as the High Court of Australia, other than those that are provided in the written reasons delivered by the judges. However, in the Mabo case, a few tiny extra glimmers of light were provided as to his reasons and approach by the former Chief Justice Mason in an interview which he gave to the Four Corners team. In the case of John Kawata's proceedings, a small number of additional vignettes have been provided by a distinguished former professor of the University of Adelaide, Professor Hilary Charlesworth. When Kawata was being decided, she was serving as one of the associates or clerks to Justice Stephen. Justice Stephen's appointment to be the next Governor General of Australia to succeed Sir Zelman Cowan had already been announced by Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser at the time that the argument in Kawata was about to begin. With his customary propriety, Justice Stephen offered to all the parties to stand aside if any party objected to his participation in the Kawata case, but none did. As we now know, had the Queensland government objected, legal history in our country would have been quite different. The Kawata ruling, upholding the validity of the Racial Discrimination Act on the basis of the external affairs power, would not have been made, at least at that time. Absent an established foundation for the validity of that act, the Queensland Government's veto on John Kawata's acquisition would have stood. Absent a later equivalent ruling, the barrier revealed in Kawata against unfavourable state government or territory laws or executive actions unfavourable to Australia's Aboriginals by reference to their race might well have been legally valid. The lines drawn by the High Court to mark off the permissible ambit of the external affairs from impermissible boundaries are sometimes disputed and disputable. There is, of course, a point beyond which the external affairs power can't be pushed, appearing as it does in a constitution whose federal character is an essential and overarching theme. But the importance of the Kawata case was that it upheld the deployment of the external affairs power in our constitution in a matter that directly impacted the laws and executive activities of state governments. And it did so in the context of basic human rights that previously had been regarded as essentially a context of purely national or domestic concerns. Because there'll be no going back on this wider vision of the Australian Constitution and its engagement with the world, John Kawata left an indelible mark on our Constitution. And the same is true of Eddie Mabo in his case. These outcomes were to prove yet another gift of the Indigenous people of our country to the broader objective of the modernisation of Australia's laws, including its constitutional law, and of the nation viewing itself. So let us never forget John Kawata, as well as Eddie Mabo, and let us thank Marcia Langton for keeping the memory of these two heroes alive. John Kawata's test case, like the later proceedings in the Wik peoples that it foreshadowed, was decided by the narrowest of margins in the High Court, 4 justices to 3. Over the years, there have been many similar outcomes where the composition of the court at a particular time has been vital to the outcome of a case. The Wick case came up for decision in 1996, in the first weeks after my appointment to the High Court. Had another nominated lawyer at that time been appointed in my stead, the outcome might have been different. Legal formalists often like to believe, and even teach, that the law is wholly objective, that its discipline is a pure science, that outcomes are always premeditated. However, experience in Australia, as elsewhere, often shows the contrary. Appointments, especially in the final National and Constitutional Court, are therefore always very important. As Julius Stone, my great law teacher, demonstrated in my youth, judges, and especially appellate judges, and particularly justices of the High Court, necessarily exhibit their legal values in their decisions. Their approaches, opinions, and life experiences inevitably influence the outcome of cases. This happens when those judges are faced through imprecision or uncertainty in the law with what Stone called leeways for choice, which they have to resolve in deciding a case. This is why our constitution, like that of other common law countries, rightly reserves the appointment of judges to the elected executive government. It is the way that governments, reflecting the changing values and aspirations of the people over time, influence indirectly outcomes long after the appointing ministers have departed the Treasury benches. Far from this being illicit or objectionable, this is exactly how our constitution is meant to work. Party political allegiance is and should be irrelevant to judicial appointment. But values and philosophy are the very essence of the judicial role. In our country, conservative federal governments generally know this well. They give effect to it without embarrassment. It was Deputy Prime Minister Tim Fisher in the Howard government who, after attacking the majority of the High Court for its decision 4-3 in the Wick case, called bluntly for the appointment of capital C Conservatives to the court. This was a call that was fulfilled. On the other hand, governments of the Australian Labor Party have frequently been apologetic, neglectful, or casual about the power of judicial appointment. Of course, it's usually easier to find capital C Conservatives amongst appointable lawyers than it is to find candidates who are or have become Liberals or legal realists. And anyhow, Labor governments can sometimes be more conservative over values than coalition ones, as we all know. With the approaching departures of Justice Gummow and Justice Hayden from the High Court of Australia, two vacancies present which will have to be filled in October 2012 and in March 2013. By our traditions, once the vacancies are filled, the appointed judges have nothing whatever to do with politics or politicians. Yet Kawarta, Mabo, Wick, and countless other cases before and since reveal the importance of every individual appointed to the High Court and to other superior courts in this country. The importance is magnified in Australia because the final court comprises but seven human actors. This is smaller than every other equivalent national final court, save for that of New Zealand. Of course, some Labor appointees, after their appointment, turn out to be legal conservatives and formalists. Some coalition appointees emerge as strong liberals and legal realists. But the point I make is that there is no escaping the importance of the constitutional power at the moment of judicial appointment. If a single one of the majority participating judges in Kawarta or Wick had held a contrary view, the history of the legal rights of Australian Aboriginals would have been significantly different. It is this fact that demonstrates how risky test cases can sometimes be for advancing the interests of Aboriginal Australians and other causes in the courts, including the High Court. Not only is much dependent on the judges, much also depends on the other actors in the drama. John Kawarta and Eddie Mabo were fortunate to have the services of Ron Caston QC and his team of lawyers. The Wick peoples were fortunate in the advocacy of Walter Sofronoff, Sir Maurice Byers, J.W. Greenwood and their team. This is not to say that the opponents were poorly represented, quite the contrary. But governments and wealthy interests can usually secure top lawyers. Vulnerable litigants with few resources are often dependent on pro bono lawyers who are willing to discount or waive their fees and to act in the interests of their vision of justice. Another risk in the equation is sometimes presented by the approaches of governments and other actors in the administration of public institutions. We now know from the researches of Professor Riley in the Kawarta case that how important was the determination of the Aboriginal Land Fund Commission to exercise its power in support of John Kawarta and his community. According to this recent research, the Commission faced not only the vehement opposition of the Queensland government against what it saw as the Trojan horse of international ideas invading their constitutional space. It also felt pressure from the Minister for Aboriginal Affairs in the Fraser government to reduce the tensions over Aboriginal rights that were emerging between the federal and Queensland government because of the demand by John Kawata. But the five commissioners stood their ground. The timing of litigation, as in legislation, can also be vital. The setting for the significant decisions in the Kawato, Mabo and Wick cases were undoubtedly fixed by the overwhelming vote of the electors in the 1967 referendum. This created a new national zeitgeist, spirit of the law of the times, to which at least the majority of the justices were not impervious. Some Aboriginal leaders have been critical about other ill-timed and poorly mounted challenges presented by private individuals. The litigation that challenged the Northern Territory intervention, for example, has been questioned on the basis that it was doomed to fail, as legally by majority it did. On the other hand, there may sometimes be merit in the fact that individuals challenge orthodoxy by approaching the independent courts. The political process in Australia is now substantially controlled by ever-diminishing numbers of Australians who join the main political parties. Because of the real power that they exert over elected government, a disjuncture now exists between democratic theory and actual political realities. The right of individuals to endeavour to subject public power to questioning and to public and legal scrutiny is a very important feature of freedom. And for my own part, I'm far from convinced that the Wirrajul case challenging the Northern Territory intervention was ill-timed or ill-conceived. The decision and the dissent, I believe, stand at least as a sharp reminder of the vulnerability of Australia's Indigenous people to the use of the Constitution, as presently interpreted, in ways that can specifically disadvantage the rights of Aboriginals when compared to every other race and ethnicity in this nation. When important principles are involved, the symbolism of subjecting power to judicial accountability and in the highest court can sometimes be potent, at least in the long term. And so, in my view, in due time, it will be with the Northern Territory intervention. Just the same, Eddie Mabo died before his challenge to the rejection of land rights was finally decided. Although John Kawata succeeded before the High Court, his family claims to their land were effectively stymied by manoeuvres that ensued both before and after his death in 1991. In fact, it was not until 2011 that Premier Anna Bligh in Queensland confirmed the decision to revoke a section of the Munca Kadju National Park in preparation for its return to John Kawata's community. And her successor, Premier Campbell Newman, has recently concluded this legal process at long last by presenting the title documents to John Kawata's community. It took 30 years to vindicate the success of John Kawata that he won in the High Court, but finally the success came. Nicole Watson, a law lecturer and a member of the Biri Guba people, has asked a pertinent question, rather similar to the question asked by former Prime Minister Paul Keating, who stood in this place delivering the Lowitja O'Donoghue oration last year. Why should Australia's Aboriginals place their trust in a legal and judicial process that rarely delivers justice that's either practical or speedy? Nicole Watson points out that in the aftermath of Mabo, Yorta Yorta and other decisions, actual access by Australian Aborigines to economic benefits from native title has been difficult to attain, problematic to prove, expensive to litigate, contested by powerful interests in the mining and extractive industries and by governments, and divisive within the Indigenous communities themselves. Given the dimension of disadvantages still so clearly faced by urban, regional, rural and remote communities of Australian Aboriginals, why should economic benefits accrue to a comparative few just because of the chance consideration of provable ancestry, where the burdens in terms of health, housing, education and imprisonment rates are so widespread? Was a different solution to Australia's poor record of Indigenous disadvantages not possible? If in the heady aftermath of the 1967 referendum we were starting again, what would hindsight suggest that we should have done in Australia? Probably our Parliament should have stuck with bold legislation while the iron was hot. We should have moved quickly to include a preambular acknowledgement of the Aboriginal and Indigenous peoples in our Constitution, embarked on a process to create a properly representative national body of all Australia's Indigenous peoples, plunged into a negotiation of a treaty, which after all was common British practice in colonial times with dispossessed peoples or their princes, even in Canada, and even in America, and even in New Zealand. This would probably have happened, but for the mistaken belief of the early British administrators in Australia that our country was terra nullius. Any such treaty would have had to address the material disadvantages of the Indigenous people, all of them, viewed as a whole and from a perspective of the time since first settlement and a comparison to the majority population. In a proper exercise to respect the self-determination promised to every people by international law, Australians should probably have created a much larger body than the Aboriginal Land Fund Commission, one with proper powers to establish a national equality fund designed to improve rapidly the conditions of all of this country's Aboriginals and Torres Strait Islanders. A return to paternalistic, unconsulted impositions, such as the Northern Territory intervention, would then probably have never have happened. With a little luck, we might have been able to consign the races power in our Constitution, which has no parallel in any other country, so 19th century, to base a power to make laws on people's race. Only Malaysia, in its protection of the people of the Malay race, has anything like it, but no other country has anything quite like our racist power. It's 19th century. We did none of the foregoing things and possibilities. This was despite, perhaps because of, the fact that Australia was one of the oldest electoral democracies in the world, with forms of representative government dating back to 1856. The benefits of native title may have proved divisive and certainly less than a panacea for the variety of Indigenous peoples often in desperate need. Still, there's no doubt that the discovery and affirmation of native title found by the courts in Mabo, protected from extinguishment in Coato, and extended and clarified in Wick, did advance the civil, community and economic interests of Australia's Indigenous peoples to the fullest extent that the courts could do. Responsibility, power and economic benefits are flowing to native title owners and communities they serve. And whilst it's true that some Indigenous people have had it lucky, this is a common feature of life for the rest of Australia's citizens. But sadly, the federal parliaments and governments have failed to follow up Coato and to introduce a grand national response. Nicole Watson says she yearns for the activism of the Tent Embassy in Canberra, for street protests, for political action by Aboriginal leaders. No one would doubt the importance of all of these initiatives. They will certainly continue in this country. But the inescapable fact of a tiny fraction of Australians who are and identify as Indigenous in a population that is often indifferent and sometimes hostile means that there has to be space for both political and legal initiatives. The question is not either or. Each process has its advantages and disadvantages. And whilst the disadvantage of cost, delay, follow-up of court orders are well illustrated by Koata, Mabo and Wick, the advantages can also be remembered. Such cases initiate a process of change, which lies outside the compromises and deals effected by those who operate the levers of political power. At their core lie judicial institutions that don't bend to the pressures of party power play and political influence. Courts introduce a random element into the power dynamic. They are more likely to be influenced by notions of justice, equality, and principle than the forces of compromise that influence and control purely political decisions. They enforce their orders, and generally their decisions will be upheld eventually. And they inject into the political discourse decisions that themselves then interact with the politics of the day. The record of the courts in this country on this issue is patchy, it is true. But the stories of empowerment told by Australian Aboriginals who were acquainted with the decisions and who were there at the time of Koata, Mabo and Wick reveal how greatly court decisions can act as a personal catalyst. They can help to mobilise self-confidence and pride in the leadership and courage of the heroes who have gone before, and to reinforce a determination to continue to expend their efforts. So a reflection on the 45 years since the referendum, the 30 years since Koata, the 20 years since Mabo, and the 15 years since Wick shows, I suggest, this much. Progress in Aboriginal advancement in Australia remains painfully slow. And a symbol of this fact can be found in the hugely disproportionate rates of imprisonment of our Australian Aboriginal citizens. But 2% of the population and 45% of those incarcerated. So shocking are these statistics that exceptionally, the Governor of New South Wales, Professor Marie Bashir, used her office to convene and encourage fellow citizens recently who demanded action, fresh and radical thinking on this issue and real change. The issues affecting Aboriginal citizens are interrelated. They're not neatly divided like different departments of state and ministerial responsibility. Homelessness, you see, and poor housing is connected with the problems of nutrition and access to clean water. These deprivations, in turn, are related to the health crisis. The health impediments are interrelated with poor educational opportunities, truancy, and despair. Australians of goodwill on all sides of politics want to see action, but the landscape is very messy. The initiatives are often disappointing in their outcomes and counterproductive in their execution. In these circumstances, there's a room and need for multiple initiatives from all branches of government, legislative, executive, and judicial, and from the private sector, the educational institutions, the churches, and civil society. Above all, from Indigenous people themselves, out of whom must come the ultimate solutions to endemic disadvantage, which the rest of the population can support and sustain. Since the decades since 1967 referenda have witnessed many heroes. They've emerged from the Indigenous community and they've been recognised in full dignity by their fellow Australian citizens because they've refused to accept indifference and hostility as an answer to legal injustice. John Koata is such a hero. So was Eddie Mabo. So are the Wick. And there have been other heroes, and many of their faces were seen in the recent documentary about the negotiations that followed the Mabo decision of the High Court. Loitsha O'Donoghue is foremost amongst these, and she was there. And there have been others, Marcia Langton, Roberta Sykes, Mick and Patrick Dodson, Larissa Berendt, Noel Pearson, Tom Calmer, and many others. Increasing numbers of younger heroes are now entering the legal profession and the universities. Political action is necessary from them, and legal action and court judgments can quicken the pace. Ideas for future political action and judicial action in Australia will surely come from the reports and recommendations of Megan Davis, a young hero. She was recently elected by the General Assembly of the United Nations in New York as the Special Rapporteur for the whole world on Indigenous peoples. We should listen to her, and we should learn from her reports. We should not ignore and reject her reports, as Australia has other United Nations recommendations in recent years. Above all, it's necessary for Aboriginals themselves to speak out and to be listened to, respectfully, attentively. I hope that in my lifetime, I do not see another initiative like the Northern Territory intervention, pressed forward for suspect motives within 8 weeks of a federal election, with no consultation in its design with the Aboriginal peoples and communities most affected. And all of this despite the recommendation that this was an absolute prerequisite for an effective and just initiative, as explained in the group whose report was said to be the cause of the intervention. To the heroes of Indigenous Australians of the past, like John Kuata and Eddie Mabo, and to other brothers and sisters, uncles and aunties, honour and praise. To the heroes who struggled but did not succeed, respects and thanks for standing your ground. To the heroes still amongst us, including Loitsha O'Donoghue, encouragement and recommitment. Look up, my people. The world is waking. The dawn is breaking to a new bright day. When none detain us, no fears defame us, nor colour shame us, nor sneer dismay.
I would now like to invite Professor Peter Buckskin, Co-Chair Reconciliation South Australia, to formally thank the Honourable Michael Kirby and acknowledge Dr. Loitsha O'Donoghue. Professor Buckskin.
Good evening, everybody. It is absolutely my welcome as Co-Chair of Reconciliation to offer a vote of thanks to the Honourable Michael Kirby. I was saying to Michael earlier this evening that I was a young undergraduate in Western Australia, about 18 years old, and I attended a forum on the weekend at the university when he was the inaugural chairman of the Australian Law Reform Commission, where a group of Aboriginal undergraduate students came to listen to you talk. And for many of us, for the first time, we saw a champion in you, Michael. We saw a person that came to speak of a language of inclusion that we were hearing for the very first time. It gave us a voice of hope as young undergraduates, and you continue to be an inspiration. Your message tonight continues to be inspirational. You provided a rare personal, committed voice as an eminent jurist. Tonight we have been privileged to hear from a true citizen of humanity, Michael. It has been our pleasure to listen to you. You're a just and fair man. You're passionate and you're a compassionate man. And we personally thank you for the values that you brought to the High Court and continue to live your life. Michael said he still needs to earn a crust, so he has his latest book in the foyer, and he is very much happy for to sign for those that wish to purchase the copy tonight. It has been our honour to listen to you tonight, the Honourable Michael Kirby. Can you please join me in thanking him through the normal way? Can I ask you to come up, please, Michael? And we continue to have amongst us, and which is this foundation has been named, this oration has been named after, our living national treasure, Lowitja O'Donoghue. Thank you for being with us tonight, and we have a gift for you.